A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 214. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about Fireball XL5. This is Brian from Canada.
And I'm Eamon from England. Hello there.
So this is one of Gerry Anderson's early Supermarionation shows. It ran 39 episodes that were about 25 minutes each. They were in black and white, and they broadcast in 1962 and 1963. And the series reflected the popular interest in the space race at the time, and in space exploration, and that was a big part of the show.
Yes, the space age was a big part of this, as we'll get to later on. But we should mention that there's a similar puppet show from about the same time called Space Patrol, which may get confused with this one, particularly as Space Patrol was produced by two former business partners of Gerry Anderson, a chap called Arthur Provis and Roberta Lee, who I think had a lot to do with Space Patrol. But we're talking about Fireball XL5 and, as you say, Brian, adventures in space and black and white supermarionation.
Yes, absolutely.
So the setup of Fireball XL5, Colonel Steve Zodiac is our hero, the best pilot in the whole world, Space Patrol, and he commands the Fireball XL5 rocket ship and its slightly ill-matched crew, perhaps we'll say, but we'll get to them in just a moment, as they head off on their adventures.
And they defend Earth from threats from aliens, rogue planets, and all sorts of strange phenomena that they find out there. And of course, it's quite a remarkable ship powered by its Newtomic reactor, and it's one of a fleet of fireball rockets. So we hear about XL9 or XL3 and so on at different times.
But we focus on XL5 and the crew, and we've mentioned them already, so we'll get to actually going into our characters. Steve Zodiac, as I said, he is the sort of stereotypical, perhaps clean-cut American astronaut hero, and he is almost inevitably now for British Invaders an American voice being done by a Canadian actor, and this time from Winnipeg itself, an actor called Paul Maxwell. They keep cropping up, these Canadian actors, Brian.
As a Winnipegger myself, I approve of that choice for that reason alone.
So they're very good. So there he is doing Steve Zodiac, the hero of the show.
And Dr. Venus, a French doctor of space medicine, designed and voiced by Sylvia Anderson herself as international new woman and sort of, I think, meant to be a fairly progressive female character. We will get to the point later that it wasn't always as progressive as maybe they wanted it to be, but interesting to have her there as a main character.
Yes, and she is quite a Sylvia Anderson character. Not quite as advanced and progressive as Lady Penelope, but you could see them heading in that direction.
Yes, and always these glamorous blonde women in these sort of powerful positions. Professor Matt Maddock is the navigator and scientist on board the XL5 with lots of theories about whatever was happening in the given episode, wearing heavy glass bottle bottom glasses and sort of a comic relief character, and that older, maybe less than complimentary idea of a professor or a scientist that we would see in shows from that era sometimes. voiced by David Graham, who would go on to voice both Parker and Brains in Thunderbirds.
Yes, that's right. And as you say, he is, Professor Matt Matic is very much the sort of eccentric scientist role with his wild sort of hair and wild ideas. And as you say, a bit of comic relief as well. And we also get a bit of comic relief from the other two members of the crew. We have Zuni, who is an alien lazoon, a sort of ape-like creature. He is a pet of Dr. Venus, and he can speak in a sort of mimic fashion. So he mimics other voices and sounds, which is a talent that sometimes gets the crew into and out of some tight spots. And of course, he provides a bit more humour. And again, his rather strange voice provided by David Graham, who was, I suppose, a master of vocal talents for the Anderson productions over the years.
Yes, and he still is doing voice work and doing interesting things with that even now. But yeah, Zuni was kind of an odd little character to have in there. But I guess it fits in the sort of early 60s children's TV genre.
And then perhaps a more interesting character with what we know about Gerry Anderson's interest in robots, we have Robert the robot, who is the co-pilot or the sort of automatic pilot on the XL5, a translucent plastic robot, but would occasionally overheat and literally get steamed up. So steam sort of comes out the top of his head in an effect which was apparently generated by them blowing cigarette smoke up through a tube up the run up the inside of the puppet. And Robert's voice, interestingly, was actually provided by Gerry Anderson himself, the only voice he ever did for any of his shows. And his robotic voice was sort of generated by using an artificial larynx device. That's one of these sort of vibrating devices you hold against your neck to help generate a voice for people who've had to have their larynx removed. And so he was using that to provide this very sort of strange robotic voice that notably, I think, can't pronounce the letter H. So it heads for ohm at various points.
Yes, again, a bit of an odd character, but certainly adds something interesting and different to this show. Commander Wilbur Zero was the head of the World Space Patrol in their South Pacific base, sending the crew of XL5 off on their missions on a regular basis, basically in each episode, voiced by the British comic actor John Bluthal.
And another sort of, I suppose, almost typical blustering official for Fireball XL5 to deal with, does a lot of ordering and shouting and commanding.
Yeah, that's right. So what we would see sort of week to week on this, the Fireball XL5 launches on a horizontal track. So it's like it shoots down this railway that then scoops upwards and fires it off into the air. And of course, as we often had in the Gerry Anderson shows, you had one bit of film, one sequence of it taking off that was reused many times throughout the series. It does look quite good, though, so it's an interesting one to see in the openings there. Once in space, the Fireball XL5 is said to use Newtomic engines to power it to amazing speeds, at one point even beyond the speed of light. The nose cone of the XL5 detaches and is then called Fireball Junior, which is a landing craft. So we sort of have some reflection of the technology of the space program at the time, where you had a capsule that was sitting at the end of a rocket. And I guess the ideas that were to come later on with the Apollo program and a separate lander capsule were sort of fit into that as well, with Fireball Jr. being usually the craft that would land on an alien planet somewhere.
Yes, they did take some little bits and pieces from current space technology at the time, the stuff they knew about. I mean, the horizontal launch, I think Anderson took because he believed, or he'd heard a story, that the Russians were planning to launch their rockets in that way. And it's a, as you say, it's an impressive sequence, apparently the first bit to be filmed, and it crops up, I think, in nearly every episode. They do, as you say, they like to reuse a launch sequence on the Anderson shows.
Yes, that was very much like what they would do later in Thunderbirds, where there were several launch and takeoff sequences that would be reused. But it was interesting that you had this sort of idea that would reflect the Mercury program that was currently being flown by the US, by NASA, where you have a rocket with a capsule on top. But they sort of turned that on its side and it used it differently. It didn't move or fly like a rocket, but it was definitely using some of those elements from the actual space program.
Okay. And then turning to the crew themselves on their missions, if you've seen any Gerry Anderson show or heard us talk about them before, you'll know that the one problem they wrestled with constantly was how to make the puppets walk in a convincing fashion. Or, I suppose, how to conceal the fact that when puppets walk, they look just very... Well, they look just like puppets, I suppose, Brian.
Yes, it was one thing that they were never really able to do with the Super Marionation shows, was to get them to walk convincingly. There were a lot of other things that they really could get them to do, but walking was extremely difficult.
So, as ever, they came up with a way to get around that, and that for Firebird XL5 and the crew is that they have hover bikes, which they use to move about once they're on the surface of these various planets they land on in Fireball Junior. So you'll see that quite often, that they'll move around on hover bikes. And then occasionally they'll also spacewalk, where they have thruster backpacks. And again, they had another problem because they couldn't really put the puppets in a spacesuit and helmet, because I presume then they wouldn't have been able to operate the heads and the eyes and the movement of the mouth. So they got round this problem by having the crew of Fireball XL5 use some rather remarkable oxygen pills when they go out in space. And a little sort of production note is that this was apparently suggested to Gerry Anderson by none other than Terry Nation when he was visiting the studios one day. He said, why not just have them use an oxygen pill? So there you go. It's interesting that Anderson was fascinated by Terry Nation's Daleks, and here's Terry Nation sort of returning the favour by giving them a little plot device.
Before he even created the Daleks, in fact.
Yeah, true. Yes, right.
Yeah, they don't address the idea that there are other problems of being out in space without a spacesuit, you know, the cold temperatures and needing protection from other things. But it was a cute little note to have the oxygen pills in there. And that sort of fit with the tone of this series.
Okay. So we're going to turn to our own production notes. And I have to, as ever, give thanks to an extremely comprehensive booklet that comes with the DVD set I've been looking at, written by, as ever, Andrew Pixley, a noted television historian who often writes about these shows we've been watching, and it's given us lots of useful information, more than actually we've got time to cover, really.
Yes, very good as always. So Gerry Anderson had success with his first production company, AP Films, and their early puppet shows, Twizzle, Torchy the Battery Boy, and then of course Four Feather Falls, which was their Western and considered to be the first Super Marionation show, because they introduced the electronics that would allow for the mouth movements to sync up with audio and so on. Supercar came along in 1961, and this sort of really showed that there was an audience for a science fiction show for children with these sort of marionette puppet type things.
Yes, that's right. And it's, as you say, Supercar's their first sort of science fiction show, and it was successful. But rather than make another series of that, it's that figure again, Lou Grade, who said, actually, I want you to make a new show rather than another series of Supercar. And as we've already mentioned, they tapped into this huge popular interest in the space race at the time. We've mentioned the successes of the Russian program. We've mentioned, I suppose, the Mercury astronauts with their triumphs and disasters that were starting to appear in the news. And so Gerry Anderson and his team came up with the idea of a show about the crew of a rocket ship. And interestingly, the rocket ship was going to be called the Century 21. Of course, a name that would stick around because they'd eventually use that as the name of their new company later on.
But soon after, Gerry Anderson was topping up his car with Castrol XL oil and liked that XL suffix and went with the fleet of fireballs that would be XL and then a number and decided XL5 had a nice sound to it. Gerry and Sylvia Anderson, who were at the time still a married couple and very much a team for producing these shows, they wrote the first episode together and Gerry Anderson directed it.
But after that, they had different writers, a trio of writers, Alan Fennell, Anthony Marriott and Dennis Spooner took over the scripting. And again, another trio of directors, Alan Patillo, David Elliott and Bill Harris. Although, as ever, with a Gerry Anderson production, he was never very far away, often watching on closed circuit TV monitors what was going on. And of course, he had to be, providing the voice of Robert the Robot, although those were recorded in advance, I believe.
Yes, I think that's right. Those were done in advance. And apparently the Gerry Anderson team, and I'm not sure which series it was where this was introduced, but they were the first ones to set up a system where you had the film camera and then a television video camera looking in through the eyepiece of that. So you could have monitors that everyone could see, not just the camera operator looking through the eyepiece to see what was being recorded on film at the time. And this, of course, became very common and standard thing to do, but apparently it was their team that first introduced that.
Ah, so that was how Gerry Anderson could keep an eye on everything.
Yes, that's right. Very early in the development of these types of things. And it was also used so that the puppeteers could see what was being recorded and make sure that they kept the puppets in frame and so on.
Okay. As ever, we've got Derek Meddins, that famous name, leading the models and special effects team. And although this is not quite up to the heights of Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet, there's still a lot of astonishing model work. There's that rather fantastic launch sequence, which I gather was quite difficult to film. And there's the usual sort of explosions and rocket blasts and jets of steam as Fireball Jr. comes into land. So it's all quite good stuff.
Yes, Derek Meddings did some great model work throughout the Super Marionation era and into live action with UFO with Gerry Anderson. And then would go on to work on the James Bond films, which he did for many years. The puppets were created and operated by Christine Glanville and her company of Five Puppet Productions team. These were about 20-inch tall puppets with the larger than human scale heads, where the bits of electronics and things for controlling the mouth movement to sync with the audio and for controlling the eye movement as well, those were inside the heads. So you needed that sort of larger sized head compared to the bodies on them at that point. And they were doing these 25-minute episodes, and it would take about 2 weeks to shoot each episode at their studio in Slough.
And then we've got the music, which we always seem to be talking about with Gerry Anderson Productions. And as ever, it's another famous name. It's Barry Gray again. And he's using that futuristic electronic keyboard instrument called the Ondas Martino, which he would later use to produce the UFO sounds for UFO. So he's using it here for the opening music, which was titled Zero G. But when you think of Firebird XL5, you probably think of the end credits song, which was called I Wish I Was a Spaceman, again by Barry Gray, performed by the singer Don Spencer, and it was released on vinyl and became a sort of minor hit, I suppose, at the time when space was in fashion. And so a space song became a minor hit, certainly in the British pop charts.
Yes, and I think it was starting to get into that era where TV-related music, you know, especially songs with vocals and what have you, could make the charts. You know, they could be popular at a certain level because of the TV connection to the music. And that opening theme was a perfectly good piece of music in there. It works well, but it is that closing theme with the lyrics that is really quite memorable.
Yes, absolutely. It's a fantastic piece of music, which we'll talk about in our next episode.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquerors of the sky.
Anderson and his financial backer toyed with the idea of filming in color, which would have been the first time that they had done that, but they decided that it was just too expensive and they would continue to work in black and white. Filming took place through 1962, with the first broadcast on October 28th of 1962. There was a lot of publicity about it in the comics and newspapers about this exciting new show from Gerry Anderson starting to become a name at this point.
Yes, and so much so that Fireball XL5 was, as far as we know, the first British show and the only Anderson show to be picked up by a single US TV network, as opposed to running in syndication, which I think the other Super Marination shows did. So NBC picked it up and they ran it in 1963, not too long after its original broadcast.
Yeah, the original broadcasts ran sort of 62 and 63, so it was not much of a delay there at all, which is interesting. At that point, often British shows going to the US or American shows going to the UK would have a significant delay there of a number of years. So it was interesting to have it following on so quickly.
Okay, so let's talk about availability and how we've been watching these episodes. Here in Region 2, I'm holding in my hands a rather nice box set, again from our friends at Network DVD, which was released in 2013. And this one actually comes with quite a lot of extras, unusually for Network TV. This one has, as I say, all 39 episodes. It's got a making-of documentary narrated by none other than Shane Rimmer. It's got a feature about the Fireball XL5 comics. It's got one episode has been colorized, and that's included here as well. Plus, there's some TV ads, some other bits and pieces. And as I say, that booklet by Andrew Pixley, which details all the stuff that went into the production of the show, and then has lots of episode guides with the usual spoiler warnings attached. Now, currently, it's on Amazon here in the UK at £24. But, you know, it's a very nice box set, which I think we're lucky to have. And over in Region 1, Brian, I think you've got something else to report.
Oh, yes. The Gerry Anderson shows, I think, have all been released in Region 1, and a number of them have been released more than once. And I think that's the case here. What I've been looking at is the Complete Series DVD set that just came out in 2015. Runs for about $19 on Amazon.com or $27 on Amazon here in Canada. And it is a fairly stripped down release, but it has those 39 episodes. It has commentary tracks on two of them. Alan Petillo, the director, and the voice artist David Graham both appear in commentaries. There is a documentary about Mike Noble's work on the Fireball XL5 comic books. And there is also an interview with Gerry Anderson himself about Supermarionation in general, sort of tracking some of the history of it. And I believe this is the first release of that documentary, even though Gerry Anderson passed away a few years ago at this point. There is also a Blu-ray release of that one colorized episode. The other 38 episodes are not included, but there is a special Blu-ray with that one colorized episode and some bits and pieces, some Four Feathered Falls, that earlier Western show. Some of that is included. And there may be some extra documentary stuff on there as well. I'm not exactly sure. I haven't looked at that one myself, but it sells for about $25 on Amazon.com.
Which does seem a little bit pricey for just one episode of Fireball XL5.
It does, but it is a sort of odd little special release that is floating around there.
Okay, but as ever, it's nice to have these DVDs and Blu-ray releases of these shows from back in the 60s. And with the Gerry Anderson shows, we're usually pretty fortunate in that they're out there on DVD, Brian.
Yes, and they're quite well put together. Although the latest Region 1 does not have that booklet that the Region 2 does and doesn't have some of the extras. But it is a nicely put together set for the episodes themselves. So that wraps things up for the first half of our discussion about Fireball XL5. Next time, we will get into a few more details about the episodes.
That's right. And we're also going to talk a little bit about Fireball XL5 spin-offs, because this was really the first huge merchandising hit for Anderson Productions. So we're going to talk a little bit about those.
And of course, we will get into some of our own reviews and recommendations. So you can reach us at BritishInvaders.com, and you can find us on Facebook. If you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find our group there with lots of good discussion with our listeners.
Or you can listen to us on the Voice of Geeks Network, that's VogNetwork.com, streaming internet radio. We go out on a Monday and a Tuesday, but they have several other interesting shows that may tickle your fancy. And you can come and join in the fun there as well, VogNetwork.com.
Absolutely. They have a nice community over there as well. So thank you for listening. This is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. And until next time, it's Eamon in England, also signing off.